Hello again. Welcome back to Vox Pop, WAMC's live afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Ray Graff. Medical Monday today, Dr. John Leibovitz is our guest. Dr. Leibovitz is chief of neurointerventional surgery at Vassar Brothers Medical Center and a neurosurgeon at New Vance Health. Fellowship trained, Dr. Leibovitz specializes in cerebrovascular neurosurgery. He has a particular focus on minimally invasive techniques and radial neurointerventions for both diagnostic procedures as well as the treatment of stroke and brain aneurysms. He also focuses on the treatment of degenerative spine and traumatic injuries to the brain and spine. He focuses on conservative care, minimally invasive treatments prior to discussing surgical options. If you have a question today, give us a call, 800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551. You can email us at voxpop@wamc.org. Dr. John Leibovitz, welcome to the show.
Hi, thank you so much.
You found the place all these miles away from Vassar Brothers. So great, man.
It was a nice drive up here today. No problem.
Really? That's good.
Yeah.
All right, it's stroke month. We might as well talk about strokes to start the show, and then we'll move on from there. This is one of those things. There's that acronym, I forget what it is, but it's important to act fast when you have a stroke.
Yeah,
right?
so be fast. That's the acronym, that's, I think, right, that you're referring to.
Yes.
And you know, it's basically giving you some good general knowledge on things that might be a stroke to help get to the hospital. And the sooner you get to the hospital, the more options you have available to you in terms of treatment and long-term outcomes.
What happens when you wait too long?
If you wait too long, the treatment options go down in terms of what you're available to have, and the stroke deficits can set in and become from an injury to a more permanent problem. So the chance of reversible changes goes down with time.
Tell us quickly and, you know, in a very sort of cliff note sort of way, what happens to your brain when a stroke happens?
So a stroke, you know, similar to a heart attack, is where different organs, obviously, but when there's a blockage in a blood vessel to the brain, that area of the brain stops getting blood. And blood is the nutrients and the energy and all of that. So if your brain isn't getting blood, it starts to die and get an injury. So the treatments are aimed at restoring the blood flow with either medications. There's clot-busting medications you can give through the IV. And then there's surgeries that people like me can perform through the blood vessels of the arm or the leg, where you can go into the brain itself and remove the blockage, restoring blood flow.
All right, hang on a minute now. I think brain surgery, I think, okay, we're going to get the saw and we're going to chop a section of the skull off and go right in. You're saying going in through the arm?
Yeah, so a lot of surgery, especially blood vessel or cerebrovascular neurosurgery, you know, we now perform minimally invasive either through the main blood vessel in the leg, the femoral artery, or you can do most things now through the radial artery in the arm. So you can put in like what looks like an IV. It's called a sheath. That basically is your access, your highway to get your equipment in. And you can use catheters, which are like long tubes. And with catheters and wires, you can now get that into the brain to either remove a blockage, like suck out the clot, or if there's a narrowing, you can use a stent. Brain aneurysms, you know, you can fill with little coils or use different stents to block the flow into the aneurysm. So we could do a lot of stuff with just a little needle stick and you go home with a Band-Aid.
So the needle stick is what the IV is, and that travels up all your arm, a few feet, right?
Yeah. So the catheters could be, you know, 5 feet long, but from how far the end is that I'm manipulating to where the end is in the body.
What if you take a wrong turn?
Yeah, you could get obviously in some trouble, but, you know, we were able to, with the systems, do what's called a roadmap. And you, with contrast, you can take a picture and then the computer makes that as like a negative or a map. And then you can navigate your catheters and wires that way up into the brain.
Our guest today is Dr. John Leibovitz, who is chief of neurointerventional surgery at Vassar Brothers Medical Center. We'll talk about strokes today, brain surgery, brain and spine conditions. The number is 800-348-2551. When you make this I've never heard about this. When you make this roadmap, do you have to assess the quality of, is it a vein or an artery you're going in?
Arteries.
Okay, so do you have to assess the quality of that and make sure there are no defects along the way before you go?
So, you know, we use ultrasound to make our initial entryway. So, you know, the ultrasound will let us know how big the artery is and know if it's, the equipment will take it and when the puncture site is okay. But between like your wrist and your chest, we generally don't take a lot of pictures. But once we get into the neck, that's when we start taking the roadmap or the pictures to make sure the arteries are okay.
When you get to the neck, so the artery is in your wrist or your hand or, or whatever. What artery are we going in?
So you start like in the radial artery, which connects to like kind of your brachial artery and your forearm, which then goes into the subclavian, which is right underneath your collarbone.
Yeah.
And then you can make a U-turn basically to go up the carotid artery to get into the brain or, you know, the vertebral artery. That's another artery you can go up into the brain with.
Isn't there the case where some people have almost 100% blockage on the carotid?
Yeah. So if it's blocked, obviously 100%, you can't get through. But if it's not blocked 100%, you know, we can perform stenting and ballooning just like we do in the heart or the legs to, you know, reopen that artery.
Is there a danger of little particulates? I mean, everyone has a certain amount of blockage at when you get to a certain age, right?
Yep. So if you're performing a procedure like a stenting, let's say, we'll place like a little basket past it to collect the particulates that you're talking about. There's another surgery, kind of a hybrid carotid stenting surgery called the TCAR. And that's where you actually kind of make a cut down in the neck and you put that sheath directly into the carotid artery in the neck. And then that sheath actually has a special section where it will suck the blood down. So you put the brain on flow reversal. So instead of the blood going towards the brain, you'll suck the blood down through the sheath and then you put it back into the leg so that any of those particles that you're referring to, instead of going towards the brain to cause a stroke, they'll go, you know, into the sheath through a filter and then back into the leg.
Couple things. One, how do you go into flow reversal? Is there a switch?
There's a switch.
No way.
Yeah. You have to kind of block you have to manually clamp the artery in the neck, and then the switch will suck.
That is amazing.
Yeah.
All right, John Leibovitz, Dr. Leibovitz, what you have just described to me scares me to death. I could never do what you do. Is there a particular psychological makeup for surgeons and brain surgeons that just make you pretty cool under pressure? I mean, this is big stuff, man.
I think you do need to have a strong psychiatric background to be able to do some of this stuff because, right, obviously in brain surgery, a millimeter could be a difference between, you know, remembering second grade and not potentially, right, as a joke, right?
But, right, I get you.
You know, it's really very small. So you have to be confident, obviously, and rely on your training, just like, you know, the airline pilots and specialized, you know, military personnel. You have to rely on the training to be able to do the job.
You're fairly confident, I can tell.
Yes, sir.
The number here is 800-348-2551. Our guest today is Dr. John Leibovitz, neurointerventional surgery chief at Vassar Brothers Medical Center. And we can talk about strokes, brain tumors, degenerative spine, traumatic injuries to the brain and spine. Our number is 800-348-2551. So this technique that you are describing is fairly new, right? Last 10, 15 years?
Yeah, so the cardiologist started going through the wrist a long time ago.
I remember that, yeah.
And, you know, in 2018, 2019, when I was in my fellowship in Philadelphia, Thomas Jefferson, that's really when neurointervention started using the radial artery. And mostly because the equipment wasn't prepared. The cardiac equipment, for example, everything's straight. If you go from the wrist, it goes right into the heart. To get into the brain, you need to make
that
really
U-turn,
a U-turn.
Yeah.
So the equipment wasn't built to be strong and supportive and all of that. And over the past, you know, 5 to 10 years, there's been equipment designed specifically for neuro from the radial artery to be able to perform these procedures.
When you use these artificial means of going through arteries, what precautions do you have to take to make sure they are completely sterile and you're not introducing something directly into the brain?
You know, the good news, most of the time the arteries are very hardy, you know, compared to other things. So infection in an artery is not impossible, but it's much more rare than other things. But most of the time, because everything is so long, you're not, you know, the stuff that's in the brain is not what you're actually touching.
But you got the blood-brain barrier, which kind of protects the brain from a lot of things, but you're going directly
there. We're going directly through it. So yeah, if you have, and if you, you know, put something, you know, snot, we'll say, right, and then you touch the catheter and put it in the brain.
Yeah,
you're going to be.
That's not a good plan.
Not a good plan. That's a bad plan.
Our guest today is Dr. John Leibovitz from Vassar Brothers Medical Center at New Vance Health. 800-348-2551 is the number. As far as operating on tumors, again, that's got to be really delicate work. That has to be done open skull, right?
Yes, but even so, brain tumor surgery over the last 10 years as well has also evolved. Pituitary surgery, for example, is mostly done through the nose with the help of an ENT doctor.
That's how the Egyptians did it.
Yeah, and there's also, you know, these little minimally invasive tubes that could be used to kind of, for brain tumors, if it's the right size, instead of making a big opening in the brain, there's these minimally invasive tubes that can make a smaller corridor into the brain to kind of push the normal brain away, let you take out the tumor, and the normal brain slides back.
Amazing. So these technologies, as you say, reduce the amount of time the patient is in the hospital, right?
And reduce the risk, right, of everything.
Does it improve outcomes?
Mostly, yes, right? So like if you could do a minimally invasive surgery, you're up faster, right? So less chance of blood clots and pain and not eating, right, and infection, right? The sooner you get out of the hospital, all that stuff goes down.
Yeah.
So, yeah, these minimally invasive techniques have for sure improved all of that.
Let's take a quick break here. Dr. John Leibovitz is our guest from Vassar Brothers Medical Center. Number is 800-348-2551. Email is voxpop@wamc.org. We'll check the email bag and hit the phones in a moment. Vox Pop on WAMC. It's Medical Monday. Ray Graff with you. We're joined by Dr. John Leibovitz of Vassar Brothers Medical Center. Today, it's brain and spine and all sorts of things like that. An email from, I don't know. You know what, doctor? I'm training the audience. I am so bad at reading these medical terms and drug names and stuff that this person actually did phonetics for me. So I hopefully will get this right. Thank you very much, whatever your name is, for doing this. I was recently diagnosed with pleomorphic adenoma, a benign tumor of the right parotid gland. My surgeon advised that during surgery, the tumor has to be peeled away from the facial nerves. I understand that even though nerve monitoring will be used, there is a risk of short-term or permanent damage to the facial nerves that control smiling, eyelid closing, etc. If permanent damage to the nerves occurs, is that something you can treat? How successful are those treatments?
So, you know, this is something that, you know, this is extracranial. This is a parotid gland. So this is really our salivary gland that we're talking about. But the facial nerve, you know, it's a cranial nerve, leaves the brain, goes to the face controlling facial expressions and things. You know, there isn't great treatments for, you know, facial nerve injury, especially, you know, more distally where this is. If the, you know, there's, you can obviously do some therapy, time, but there's not like reimplantation surgery or, you know, nerve transfers or anything like that, that I'm aware of. That is not something that is, you know, well documented that I'm aware of.
All right. John writes in, does the doctor have anything to say about possible causes? Bilateral retinal ischemia. My retina specialist is stumped. I'm not diabetic. I've had ultrasounds on my carotid arteries, CT scan on my head, neck, orbitals, specifically. No sign of anything. I've had nuclear stress tests of my heart in the last few years for other reasons. All good. Optic nerve looks healthy. Any opinions about why blood is not getting to the periphery retinas?
Yeah, that's pretty tough. You know, the retinal artery is, you know, a small artery off the ophthalmic artery that goes to the eye. And, you know, there is a diagnosis. If you get a stroke or you can get a clot that goes into the central retinal artery, you can go blind. Like the person said, most of the time you have stenosis in the carotid artery. You have a blockage somewhere else. You have vascular disease. So if everything is clean, you know, that's a pretty tough situation. You know, the one thing, you know, did they do a CT angiogram or an MR angiogram of the blood vessels in the brain? You know, just like you can have carotid artery disease in the neck, you can have carotid artery disease in the brain. And if so, is that contributing to the ischemia or the decreased flow into the orbital area?
So really, there's not a heck of a lot you can do with an email. You'd have to see the patient.
Yeah, you got to see them.
That's kind of a problem with Medical Monday, but we do the best we can.
We try.
Dr. John Leibovitz is our guest, neurointerventional surgery chief at Vassar Brothers Medical Center and a neurosurgeon at New Vance Health. The number, once again, is 800-348-2551. Claire is in Albany. Hello there, Claire. How are you?
Hi, thank you for taking my call.
You got it.
Doctor, I had a stroke in 2015, and I was in the hospital for just a day and a half, and they stuck a needle in my finger, and I was released. It's now 2026, and recently my right arm has been tingling as though it's asleep. And I wonder if it's due to the stroke that I had. Here's an example. I mistakenly picked up a cup of coffee and I couldn't hold it. It fell out of my hand.
Yeah.
And I know that lately when I try to pick something up off the floor, I can't feel it.
So, you know, that could be coming from a lot of things. You know, given that you had a stroke 10 years ago and this is a new finding or a new symptom, it's hard to really attribute that to the prior stroke. Obviously, God forbid, this could be a new small stroke that you're having, or it could even be a problem in your neck. You know, a lot of people can have cervical spine stenosis or narrowing, and that can cause difficulty using your hands, lack of coordination, lack of strength. So, you know, this is definitely something I think you should talk about with your doctor. And depending on, you know, your symptoms, you might need some imaging of either your brain or your spine.
Claire.
Yeah, I think you hit it on the head. I have been having neck troubles. That's it. I thank you.
Yep.
I think I'll live another couple of years.
Yep. Well,
thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Thanks, Claire. 800-348-2551. That's the number. Dr. John Leibovitz is here from Vassar Brothers Medical Center. Let's go to Carl in Hudson. Carl, you're on.
Thank you for taking my call. Unfortunately, I don't think I think I've lost the connection. I can't hear you.
We can hear you. Can you hear us? Hello?
Perfect.
Okay,
here we go.
Yep.
Yes. So I've been bombarded with these advertisements for a pillow-type device which goes under the neck and manipulates or heats or activates pressure on the vagal nerve. Is that correct? The reason why I ask is because our daughter has been diagnosed with multiple symptoms that they're referring to as MCAS. And the more I read about this area of the C4, C5, they seem to attribute it to some type of blockage in that area, which this pillow would then ostensibly relieve. Does it sound like is it just another gimmick, or am I up the right road?
You know, this is something that's pretty new, and I'm not that familiar with, to be honest, with vagal nerve stimulation for, you know, MCAS specifically. You know, vagal nerve stimulators are used for a lot of things, like controlling seizures, sleep apnea, you know, all sorts of different diseases. There's implantable ones where you have to have surgery, and now there's external vagal nerve stimulators like you're talking about here. But specifically with MCAS, that's something that I am not familiar with, unfortunately.
Well, thank you for your time, and continue on, gentlemen. Appreciate it.
Carl, thanks a lot for the call.
Thank you.
Very wise decision not to try to opine on that, something you don't know about.
Yeah, that's one of my rules. I would rather just say I don't know than guess, you know?
That's a good plan.
Yeah.
From a legal standpoint and otherwise.
Yeah.
800-348-2551 is our number. Dr. John Leibovitz joins us. Dr. Leibovitz is chief of neurointerventional surgery at Vassar Brothers Medical Center and a neurosurgeon at Nuvance Health. Then let's see here, an email, and then we'll go back to the phones. This is from Jen. Any idea why I'm hearing a whooping sound in my ears and feeling a jolt in my body when my eyes move back and forth? I was referred to a neuro-ophthalmologist who I haven't seen yet, and I was also recently stopped taking my antidepressant. I titrated down with a psychiatric nurse, but this is one symptom that nobody mentioned to me.
You know, so tricky. You know, she's almost like she's describing two different things. You know, the eye movements could be something like nystagmus, and the whooshing sound, you know, in the ear could be something like tinnitus.
Yeah.
You know, sometimes people could have tinnitus from hearing loss, from ear damage. You could also have tinnitus if you have something called venous sinus stenosis. So the main brain veins are called sinuses, you know, different than like your sinuses in your in your face. And if you have transverse, that's one of the sinuses, transverse sinus stenosis, a lot of people could have pulsatile tinnitus, and you can actually relieve that with stenting.
You're kidding me.
Doesn't normally occur with nystagmus or these eye symptoms. But, you know, if you were to have pulsatile tinnitus, where it sounds like your heartbeat in your ear, and venous sinus stenosis, there's excellent treatments now that either through the arm or the leg, you can, again, bring your equipment into the vein side this time instead of the arteries, and you can stent back open the vein, and the tinnitus goes away.
So if you had to guess or make a bet, you'd bet that at least two things were going on here, separate.
Or it's all related to our medicines, because, you know, some of the psychiatric medicines can have different effects outside of the, you know, the mental status, right? And I like time frame, right? And her history is, I came off these medicines, I had these symptoms,
yeah,
right? So I think we need more info, but it could just be a medicine problem.
The number here is 800-348-2551. May is stroke month. Dr. John Leibovitz joins us. He is the chief of neurointerventional surgery at Vassar Brothers Medical Center. And let's go back to our phones. Gene is in Colony. Gene, you're on. Gene, you got to turn your can you turn your radio down, Gene?
Oh, I'm within 15 feet. I'll go turn it off.
All right. That's splendid. 16 feet. That'll be about 20 seconds. So are you a Mets fan at all, John? Okay. She's back. Hello, Jean. Go ahead.
Hi. I'm just asking just to see if you have dealt with anybody. I'm doing pretty good now, but I wound out. It actually was probably 2 years ago by now. I woke up one morning and I was from the neck up, and I mean, you know, the back of my skull, the, you know, front ears, eyes swollen, tongue swollen, and I look like fire engine.
Oh,
and
boy.
Big lumps on my skull, all different sizes, all over the place.
Oh boy.
It was unbelievable and painful, naturally. So I called my primary care. Not that I thought she'd do anything, but she, you know, said, no, I think you've got to go to one of the stop-in places. Well, I did. I went out in Latham, and those poor nurses, there was three of them looking at me, and it was like, oh, my God. And, of course, then they went and, you know, checked me for the variant that was out there, which, of course, had nothing to do with this. But it was wild, and it took a long time for... I mean, they couldn't do anything for me. I had a laugh. They put me on an antibiotic. oh, God.
Hopefully
but
it got
I
better.
Up, well, it, what it turned out to be, but it was about 6 months later that I got a call asking me to come to this doctor that was down in Memorial, which I did. And he had been starting to deal with it. And what it was is... brain COVID, absolutely brain COVID. They had no name for it at that point.
Hang on, Gene. Brain COVID? I swear to you. I mean, I was on the air during the entire pandemic. I had virologists on and everything else. I'd never heard of brain COVID in my life. Are you sure?
Yeah, well, they didn't have a name for it at that point. They didn't even have, like, there wasn't any way they really could check on me because they didn't have enough substantial information. But what they said was it was affecting people who had 30 years worth of migraine headaches, which I did. I had had at least 30 years of horrific, and then they stopped.
Okay.
And then they started up again. And it's waning off a little now. The migraines, you know, but they were, you know, pretty intense for a bit, but I have not heard anything else ever about it. And it was unbelievable. And my eyes are still red. And it's been a couple of years, but
jeepers.
Painful as all get out.
That's terrible.
And no one knew, you know, it wasn't out there yet. And you still don't even hear about it.
Okay. So, did you lose the headphones?
Has she heard about it?
Okay. Let's talk to the doc and let's see what the doc has to say.
You know, given that, you know, so many people have had COVID, and I think we learned a lot about it, but we really don't know the whole story, right? And you know, what you're describing, unclear to me. You know, I'm not familiar with this brain COVID. There's, you know, a lot of complaints, obviously, that that we're calling long COVID, and brain fog is kind of one of them.
Yeah, yeah.
But, you know,
well, I think
resurgence of migraine headaches and the rash or whatever these, that I'm not familiar with, to be perfectly honest.
Gene, but we got to wrap it up, but go ahead. You can finish it up.
All right. No, you go ahead. I was going to say, you know, the thing was at that time, I mean, it was so painful and nobody knew what it was. That's the, you know, the problem with things like this. Is nobody knows about it.
I love that. I don't love that you have it, but I love that you brought this topic up, Gene. And I'm going to take it up for you now. Thank you for the call. So we have these idiopathic sort of conditions. In your line of work, are you ever stumped? Do you say, gosh, what is this?
You know, I think definitely, right? Because there's what's most interesting in my line of work is actually spine, right? Because a lot of people will have an MRI of their lower back that shows some type of disc bulge, disc herniation, arthritis, et cetera. And a lot of times it's not related to where the person's pain is. And it's, you know, frustrating for the patient, and it's frustrating for me as the physician or surgeon, right? Because they come in with the problem and, you know, they're like, well, look, my MRI says I have a disc herniation here, right? But the disc herniation where it is not where the expected, you know, symptoms would be, right? Or you can have a normal MRI and really bad pain. And it's you know, what's, I think, part of, you know, people get spine surgery a bad rap is if you can't just operate on the MRI, right? You kind of have to put it all together. And sometimes when it doesn't fit, obviously, in my opinion, surgery is the wrong answer, right? If it's not all matching, that's not the time to be, you know, doing surgery.
We're joined today by Dr. John Leibovitz of Vassar Brothers Medical Center, a neurosurgeon at New Vance Health. Somebody walks in like Gene with a range of symptoms. And perplexing. How do you even know the right doctor to send, Gene? I mean, she's had so many different symptoms. Where do you start?
You know, that's what's tough, right? And we're all talking about, you know, the coming of AI and all this kind of stuff, right? You need to be able to filter out the noise. And I think, you know, I would start with, like, let's find out what are the most dangerous or concerning symptoms, and let's figure out how to evaluate those. And then the more, you know, not less concerning or more benign or more generic symptoms, right? Well, I would worry about those second or third.
All right, let's go back to our phones. 800-348-2551. Beth is in Greenville, New York. Hello, Beth.
Hello.
Hey, Beth.
Go ahead.
Hi there. So I was diagnosed with MS over 10 years ago. I did a few courses of different treatments and was treated with cladribine about 3 years ago. I've had no more MS symptoms
well,
since then. However, I've developed a lot of, like, arthritic symptoms since the cladribine, which could be, you know, just that I'm getting older and have arthritis. But I'm now starting to notice some spinal things happening, lower spine. I've had several lumbar punctures with the treatment.
Okay. Did we lose Beth?
And I'm just wondering,
No, you're good. Go ahead.
So I've had several lumbar punctures in that general area that I'm now having some issues. I'm just trying to decide, like, what doctor do I need to see?
Yeah.
Do we think this is a neuro issue? Should I be looking at this as arthritis? It's just so happens to be, like, in the general area of lumbar punctures, and I'm just wondering, I guess, where I should start to get to the bottom of this new symptom.
Sure. So, you know, as a neurosurgeon or spine surgeon, you know, the symptoms that concern us the most are back pain that also has leg symptoms, so radiating leg pain, you know, numbness, tingling that starts in your back, goes down the leg, God forbid weakness, or, you know, with MS, it's a little tricky, but if you have bowel or bladder symptoms, you know, that's more concerning that you might have a real spinal compressive issue, things like that. So if it's mostly localized back pain, you know, I think starting with, you know, just even your regular doctor, right, getting an x-ray, something easy, starting with some physical therapy and stretching and anti-inflammatories, right? That's generally a good first step if you don't have any of those red flag type symptoms, which are really the neurologic symptoms. And then obviously, if you don't have the radiating leg pain and things like that, the chance of this being a surgery, which are not that you want that, are pretty low. So I think, again, starting with just your regular doctor, right? Or if you have MS, your neurologist might be a good person to, you know, go start with.
Okay. All right. Well, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Thank you very much for the call. Let's take a quick break. Dr. John Leibovitz joins us, neurointerventional chief of surgery at Vassar Brothers Medical Center. We'll take a quick break, and then we'll zip back to the phones and the emails. It's Vox Pop. It's Medical Monday. Home stretch straight ahead. Yeah, Benny Carter wrote that one. That's Basie and the Orchestra, Vine Street Rumble. 800-348-2551 is the number. It's Dr. John Leibovitz Day here on Medical Monday. Dr. Leibovitz is chief of neurointerventional surgery at Vassar Brothers Medical Center and a neurosurgeon at New Vance Health. And it looks like just one email here maybe at this time, and then we'll jump back to the phones. This is from William. The last MRI showed loss due to radiation therapy after cancer removal. This was a delayed reaction. Will this continue because of vascular damage? It's a very succinct email, and I'm not sure there's enough info in it.
That's kind of what I was about to say. It's a good question, but I'm not entirely sure we know enough. You know, we don't even know the location where there's this damage, right? I wish we had more info, to be honest.
Okay, I got to be honest. I always ask listeners to keep it brief on the emails. I think William might. If you want to follow up, William, with a little more detail, I'll come back and we'll do it. But we don't even know when the last MRI was, right?
Yeah, right. And what the tumor type was and all that.
Okay.
I think we need a little more info.
All right, buddy. So if you want to email again, Jim is in Matamoros. Jim, go ahead.
I was a ventricle atrial shunt performed.
Did you get any of that?
Can you try? I want to make sure I understand. What are we talking about? Is this a shunt or a stent?
A stent, right?
Yeah. A ventricle atrial shunt.
Oh, a shunt. Okay.
All right. Well, how's it performed?
So, you know, this is something you probably were talking about for something for hydrocephalus. So hydrocephalus is too much fluid in the brain. And there's different types of shunts. The most common is called a ventricular peritoneal shunt, where you have a catheter or tube in the brain, and that goes through a valve on top of the skull and goes into the abdomen area. For some reason, you know, some people don't use that type of shunt. You can put it in the pleural space, which is around the lungs, or in your question, the atria, which is, you know, into the heart. So instead of the tubing that you connect all the way into the belly, you bring that up into the chest, and similar to how we can put in, you know, a port or a big IV for patients with chemotherapy and whatnot, you could do the same kind of thing where you put that all under the skin into the veins, into the heart. So you'll drain the excess fluid from the brain directly into the heart.
All right, Jim.
Okay, thanks.
Thanks a lot for the call. It's Medical Monday. Dr. John Leibovitz joins us from Vassar Brothers Medical Center. The number is 800-348-2551. Susan's in Poughkeepsie. Hello, Susan. You're on.
Yes, hi. I have a question about a family member of mine. He's now, I believe, 38. When he was 34, he had a stroke in his eye after having COVID. He lost about 30% of his peripheral vision, and he seems now to be well managed on, you know, blood pressure medication. I know he has some back pain, but I'm wondering if he has an increased risk going forward because of that incident, and, you know, what would you think about what happened to him?
You know, so given that he had stroke at a young age, you know, most of the time I would say people would be at increased risk of another stroke the rest of their life. Usually once you have one stroke, you know, even when you go see the neurologist, the stuff they try to do is secondary stroke prevention, which is really trying to prevent the next stroke. You know, and that focuses on blood pressure control, diabetes control, cholesterol control, diet, exercise, smoking, you know, lifestyle changes. You know, given that he had a stroke during COVID, you know, we know that COVID did have some people that had increased risk of clots, right? Strokes in young people was a very common thing that we saw during COVID. And that was just related to the inflammatory response of the infection. So, you know, if he really is an overall healthy person and had a stroke related to COVID, hard to say. You know, his risk of future strokes, but I would do the same thing with anyone else that had a stroke, which is that good secondary stroke prevention and, you know, being on an antiplatelet, cholesterol medicine, no diabetes, exercise, diet, no smoking, things like that.
But one follow-up question. I know he's like 6'5". Does that play any role in this?
I don't have any...
Or lead to increased risk? You know, does that, having that larger frame and that big a body, does it make it harder for the blood to flow or anything like that?
You know, in general, I don't think height is in a kind of an independent stroke risk factor. Usually at times if you're, you know, a bigger person, maybe, but generally height is not really a factor here.
I've never even thought of that.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
What about some of these 7-footers, 7'5"?
Right. Yeah. You know, like all the centers in the NBA, we don't hear like a lot of strokes in those patients.
Well, they get exercise.
Right. Someone had mentioned that to me and I had never heard of that either. Okay. Thank you very much.
Hey, appreciate you're welcome.
Susan. Just quick follow-up there. You had mentioned that during the pandemic, you saw, not you specifically, but the medical profession saw an increase in the number of young people having strokes. When that happens, is the way you treat it any different when it's a young person as opposed to somebody sort of in the sweet spot for strokes, which is 50s through 70s?
Or even older, right?
Yeah.
So I think the answer is no, right? That's the same type of problems. I think maybe the changes might be people might be more aggressive, right? If you're, let's say, offered the intervention for a stroke and you're in your 90s, you might say, you know, I don't want to go through that, or I don't want to go through the rehab, et cetera. But if you're in your 20s and 30s, you're more likely to say yes to, you know, aggressive intervention given your age. But the treatments are, you know, the same, right? If there's a blockage in a blood vessel, try to break it either with medications if you're in the window, surgically. God forbid with stroke, if you can't, the younger you are, you could have swelling, right? When you have an injury, you're just anywhere, your arm, your brain, it can swell. So the younger you are, you're kind of, and you have a big stroke, you're actually at a risk of so much brain swelling, you know, you might need to take off part of the skull. Because you need to make room for that brain to swell if you can't get the treatment done or a treatment effective. So younger person might get more therapies, I would say, than an older person.
Dr. John Leibovitz is our guest. Dr. Leibovitz is Chief of Neurointerventional Surgery at Vassar Brothers Medical Center. Let's go back to the phones. 800-348-2551. Lorraine is in Millbrook. Hello, Lorraine.
Hi. I'm calling about severe scoliosis in elderly adults. That's me. I have an S curve. It's 60 degrees on the lower part of the curve. According to a recent chest x-ray, I'm getting a little bit of crackling in the lower left lung, which my doctor says could lead to collapse of the lung. Also, I was on board for an L10 fusion surgery. And I was very, very eager for it. I knew that it was very risky. It's a 7 or 8 hour surgery, as I'm sure you know. But I couldn't get a second or third opinion to agree with me, and my husband was greatly against it. What do you think about that kind of surgery in someone my age? Oh, and I forgot to say, like a previous caller, I do have MS. It's secondary progressive. I use a brace. I have the usual symptoms of fatigue and such, but I'm still ambulatory with AIDS.
Sure. So, you know, I think that it kind of goes back to what I said before, right? Just because you have a spine finding on an MRI, that doesn't necessarily mean we need to fix all findings, right? I think we need to focus on what your clinical problem is, right? You're having worsening pain. You're having a neurologic function. We have x-rays that show that your scoliosis is progressive, right? And then you know,
yes, absolutely.
And then
given
your
with Clovis.
Yeah. So then again, given your age, you know, is there a smaller operation that can kind of relieve your findings, or do we have to go for broke? And can you tolerate that? Right. So I think there's a lot of questions. Scoliosis is tricky for sure. You know,
is there a less invasive surgery available?
Well, again, it depends on what the symptoms are. Sometimes if you have a pain, sometimes you can do a more simple nerve decompression to kind of relieve your symptoms instead of trying to, you know, fix the deformity.
We were going for fixing the deformity because I can't stand up straight now and I can't sit up straight. And that was bothering me a lot because
it limits my ability to, you know, live my life.
Sure, of course. Well, you know, one of my partners at Vassar Brothers, Dr. Gilligan, Jeff Gilligan, is a scoliosis trained surgeon, and you know, he would be a much better person in kind of my orbit of people to do to see him.
Yeah.
I don't know how far away you are, but
well, I have to tell you, I agree with you entirely. I think he's terrific. He would have been my surgeon if I could have pulled everybody together, but I was so impressed with him. And he told me, you know, 3 weeks rehab, probably in the hospital for a week before that. I felt very good about it, and I haven't put it out of my mind completely. He knows everything I just told you.
Good.
And he's wonderful.
I agree. I probably would be helping him in the operating room, to be honest with you.
All right. Remember we had the email from William, and it was a little vague as to the MRI and everything else. So I have a little more detail on that, Dr. Leibovitz.
Okay.
Brain tumor, 77 millimeter removal in 2022. The last MRI was 2 weeks ago. It showed loss due to radiation therapy after cancer removal. This was a delayed reaction. Will it continue because of vascular damage? Now it makes sense.
Yeah, usually not, right? I mean, usually after surgery or radiation, most of the effects happen shortly after and not in a very delayed fashion. You know, the delayed findings after brain tumor treatments usually would be, God forbid, recurrence.
Yeah.
Sometimes you get something called radiation necrosis, where the brain kind of starts to die from the radiation. Again, usually that's in the 1 to 2 year mark. You know, so this doesn't sound like this is that. This just sounds like there's been some changes in atrophy from killing the cancer and the treatments that they've had. Without a symptom, I wouldn't be very concerned about this.
So radiation is standard procedure on brain cancers?
Most brain tumors, you do a, you know, like if it's a primary brain cancer, like a glioblastoma, God forbid, the treatment is really surgery to remove as much as you can, plus chemotherapy and radiation afterwards. If you have a metastatic tumor, again, it's either just radiation or removing the tumor followed by radiation. So most brain cancers do get some type of radiation.
How do you control how far that radiation goes? There's a lot of stuff in the brain. It does different things. How do you control that?
So most of the machines that we now use for radiation to brain tumors are very, very highly specialized, and they can give radiation to a specific area and within a millimeter, no radiation. So the drop-off, it's very focused, and then the drop-off is very quick. So you're able to deliver high-dose radiation to where you want it, but it's so focused that the surrounding brain doesn't get as much or get very little of that radiation.
How do you map the point you want to hit?
You know, you get a high-resolution MRI, and then it's like, you know, computer software, right? Like CAD, like you're going to go, you know, build anything else. You tell the computer where some important functions are, right? We had people talking about the optic nerves, right? So when you give brain radiation, we need to know where the optic nerves are. We need to know where the brainstem is. There's a few other areas that you have to specifically draw out, and then the computers are able to kind of calculate the correct angles that the radiation can be given to minimize damage to those high important structures.
Technology is amazing. Let's go back to the phones with Dr. John Leibovitz. Myra is in South Hadley. You're on.
Hi. Yes, I had a question about high blood pressure preceding a stroke. Is that, I mean, should you be careful if your blood pressure and you've had a headache? Today, for me, that's what happened. Like, I've had a headache all morning, and it's a little better, but I checked my blood pressure, and it was 177. That was about an hour ago, over 88. And then I just checked it again, and it was 168 over 89. And I've had a pretty bad headache. I am on blood pressure medicine, a very low dose of acetaminophen and hydrochlorothiazide, but on both of them, they're pretty very low dose. But I've also I don't tend to take them every single day.
Yeah. So, you know, high blood pressure by itself can cause a headache, unfortunately, right? And if you have long-standing high blood pressure, just like it can cause injury or damage to your heart or other organs, it can cause damage in the brain. So it can make the small little brain blood vessels more fragile and leaky, causing, God forbid, bleeding in the brain.
Mm.
And, you know, uncontrolled high blood pressure can cause, you know, other, you know, it could cause a hemorrhagic stroke, right? And so in a bigger blood vessel. So, you know, but by itself, you know, blood pressure, you know, can cause a headache, right? If you come into the emergency room with a high blood pressure, a lot of those patients have a headache. So, you know, I would definitely talk to your doctor about. Yeah, I would, but it, so a headache again could be from so many things, but having elevated blood pressure and a headache, those kind of go together. And if you're if you're on medicine that you don't take routinely, I would maybe talk to your doctor about a better, longer option or a different option, maybe one pill, a combination pill, et cetera, because, you know, we don't want you to have a stroke.
No way. Well, thank you very much for the call. While we have a moment, and dovetailing off Myra's call, let's talk, and since it's stroke month, let's talk about those symptoms that will make you want to, you know, if I was Myra, I'd be like, I better call the doctor because this is weird, but I'm a hypochondriac. Let's talk about those signs. And let me ask you this. When you give me those signs, is it something that the person who's having the stroke even notices? That's the question.
So sometimes the person will notice, sometimes not. It depends how severe they are, right? If it's minimal or if they're so, they could be so strong and impaired that the person's not awake or alert enough to talk to you, right? So if we use the stroke acronym BFAST, you know, this is really for lay people, right? So B is for balance. So, right, if you have difficulty with your balance, you're falling. E is for eyes. You know, if you can't see, blurry vision. F is for face. Do you have weakness in one side of your face? You know, A is for your arm. Do you have weakness in your arm? S is for speech, slurred speech, inability to talk, inability to understand. And T is for time, and which is really kind of what we focus on, because the sooner you get to the hospital, the more treatments you have available. And the sooner you get to the hospital, the higher chance that those treatments will be, you know, successful.
Regarding the intelligence, no, the intelligibility of speech and understanding it and making things understandable to others, I have heard that some people who are having strokes think they're speaking just fine.
Yep. So, you know, so aphasia, right, that's the fancy medical term for difficulty with speech. And you can have, you know, a receptive aphasia where you do not understand what people are saying. But if you wanted to have your own thoughts, you might talk intelligently. Right. Or you can have expressive aphasia where you will just have, you know, word salad. You'll just respond, you know, what's the weather today? And you might say blue or, you know, I want a salad. Right. Where it doesn't even make any sense.
Right.
And then you can have global aphasia where you can't really put the things together. So there's so many complexities to having a speech problem. But so it's you might think you're speaking fine, but you might, because you don't understand what someone's saying, you're just going to be talking. Right. And you won't know.
Well, so it's aphasia.
Aphasia, right, which, you know, some of the, you know like the celebrities have had, and it was all in the news a few years ago.
I think my listeners could tell you I've had this for years. Hey, man, thank you for being here. Dr. John Leibovitz of New Vance Health and Vascia Brothers, great to have you here. Enjoy that sandwich on the way.
I appreciate it. Thank you.
Support comes from Foresight Land Services for over 50 years, offering civil engineering, land surveying, planning, and environmental permitting to private and municipal clients in the Berkshires and Eastern New York, foresightland.com. Thanks again to Dr. John Leibovitz of New Vance Health for being here. Thank you for listening. Tremendous calls today. Great emails. Thank you, thank you, thank you. Sorry if we didn't get to your question. Thanks to our engineer sitting in today at the board, Riley Phillips. Good job. Thanks to Jim Mountier, who's now our regular Monday screener. Oh, boy, are you in for some fun. We'll see you. Thanks to me. Oh, all right. Well, you're welcome, Ray. Tomorrow, it's car maintenance and repair with Gordon Fricke. We'll see you, too.